This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with award-winning poet Reginald Dwayne Betts.
He went from jail to Yale and is now practicing law in Connecticut.
Jewish Voice for Peace has started a new campaign called Deadly Exchange, ending U.S.-Israel police exchanges, reclaiming safety.
Just like good recipes are kitchen-tested, Israel has field-tested how to control and dominate the Palestinian population, and they're selling that knowledge around the world, including to American police forces.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Toni Morrison said, quote, "All of that art for art's sake stuff is BS. Are you really telling me that Shakespeare and Auschwitz weren't writing about kings? All good art is political. There is none that isn't. And the ones that try hard not to be political are political by saying we love the status quo. We've just dirtied the word politics, made it sound like it's unpatriotic or something. That all started in the period of state art, when you had the communists and fascists running around doing this poster stuff, and the reaction was, no, 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 there's only aesthetics. My point is that it has to be both, beautiful and political at the same time. I'm not interested in art that is not in the world. And it's not just the narrative, it's not just the story, it's the language and the structure and what's going on behind it. Anybody can make up a story." Today on Law and Disorder, we are delighted to welcome the award-winning poet Reginald Dwayne Betts. An honor student and class treasurer in high school, at age 16, he and a friend carjacked a man who'd fallen asleep in his car. Betts was charged as an adult and spent more than 8 years in prison, where he completed high school and began reading and writing poetry. Betts' first collection of poems, Shahid Reads His Own Palm, won the Beatrice Howley Award, and his memoir, A Question of Freedom, a memoir of learning survival and coming of age in prison, received the 2010 NAACP Image Award. His recent book of poems, titled Bastards of the Reagan Era, has received wide public acclaim. He's had a Soros Fellowship, a Radcliffe Fellowship, and a Ruth Lilly Fellowship. In addition to attending Yale Law School, Betts was appointed by President Obama to the Coordinating Council of the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. Dwayne, welcome so much to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We'd like to ask you a bit about your childhood and how you got interested in poetry.
That's interesting. I think the two probably are completely unrelated. I didn't read much poetry in school. I probably started writing poetry in middle school, ninth grade maybe, and it was just to girls, to one girl actually. But I didn't think of it as a thing that was a way to communicate with the larger world. It was really just a way to kind of share some kind of intimacy with a close friend of mine. But then in prison, and I went to prison as a child too, so I think in that way it's really closely intertwined. But I went from writing love poems to being 16 years old in solitary confinement and suddenly finding Dudley Randall's The Black Poets in my hand. And that book introduced me to Etheridge Knight, Robert Hayden, Sonia Sanchez, Amiri Baraka, Nikki Giovanni, and a whole host of black writers and black poets. And it was Etheridge in particular who made me think that that poetry was a medium in which I could say something in song about the conditions that I was living in, and that it could be relevant. And actually, because he had been in prison, it made me think that it was a possibility that I could move from, you know, being incarcerated to being a poet.
What kind of support, if any, did you get while you were imprisoned and writing poetry? Did you share it with others? Did you get feedback?
Yeah, that's a difficult question, in that and that one version of the answer is to talk about how depraved conditions in prison are, and that would be true. But another version of the answer is to admit that, you know, I had long stretches in solitary confinement where my only audience was the person in the cell beside me. who would listen to all of my extremely mediocre poems, at that they were probably horrible, actually. And so so I got support from people around me. And then also, like I'm going to prison, I'm going to a prison on Friday to speak at a prison on Friday at a graduation. And it's in Virginia, so I was locked up in Virginia. And one of the guys that sort of organized it and paved the way for me to be invited there is somebody that I used to share poetry with all the time when we were incarcerated together. And we would walk around the yard and we would have these conversations about Sanchez and Knight and, you know, Haight and even more contemporary poets at the time, like Cornelius Eddy. So yeah, I think prison in its own way was, I created a very supportive community. I mean, it was in prison when I first read a poem publicly. It was at a Black History program. So yes.
Can you talk a bit about how long you were in solitary confinement? And was it for sort of the usual infractions that happened behind bars?
I was in solitary confinement 5 different times. The first time was just because they wanted to keep me and my co-defendant separated, and they only had 1 juvenile wing. So they just didn't know what to do with me, so they left me in the hole. And that was my first 9, 10 days at the Fairfax County Jail, of which for 8 of those days I didn't have a mattress, a blanket, a sheet, or a pillowcase. I had this little, like, natty half of a blanket that they gave me, and I didn't have a mattress. I was sleeping on a concrete slab in February during one of the worst snowstorms in the DMV region. So that was my first experience in solitary. And then subsequently, it was almost as if I went every summer, and it was usually for incidental contact with correctional officers. Once I, like, touched the officer's arm, once I took an officer's hands off me, I didn't like how he was searching me. And once I went to the hole for cursing at a guard and for giving somebody the finger in a very non-aggressive way, I might add. But I got 30 days in the hole for that, 15 for the finger and 15 for the swear word. So yes, I was frequently in solitary confinement, but never in my eyes for anything that warranted being in a hole. And in fact, it was certain situations where, like the last time I was in a hole, I had gave a guard the finger and cursed at the guard, and they sent me to the captain's office, and I let him know what happened, and I said, look, my temper got the best of me, but honestly, I wasn't even mad. I just wanted to express my disdain for them. So I gave him the finger, and he was like, look, just don't do it again. And he sent me back, and they waited till the shift changed and approached the next captain and said that they were afraid of me, and I was like a threat to security, and the next thing I know, I was in a hole. So from my perspective, it was never for anything that was really serious. It was just one of those things where it was easy to get sent to the hole.
Very easy. How would you say that prison changed you?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I can't disentangle who I am from the kid who went to prison. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I went to prison so young that I was becoming who I was when I was in prison. So it's impossible, actually, for me to disentangle the two. And in some ways, that's good, because I've been relatively successful. One of the narratives that we use to support this idea that we should incarcerate more and more people is that the people in prison aren't able, capable, or wanting to be contributing members of society. And that's a false narrative. So in some ways, the fact that I can't find a place where, you know, I am who I am without prison, or I am who I am with prison, I can't find a line of demarcation, that's good for me, because I think it makes me an argument for changing some prison policies and an argument for giving some of my friends an opportunity to come home and really have a chance at life, as opposed to the sort of half-life that you live in while incarcerated.
Yeah, you know, I've come over the years to the conclusion that, with a couple of exceptions, I suppose, for extremely violent and dangerous people, we should abolish prisons, and we certainly should start with juvenile prisons. But I wanted to ask you about law school, an experience that both Heidi and I share with you. What's it like going to law school these days?
I don't know. I mean, I had fun in law school, actually. And when I say I had fun, I think it was intense, obviously. But it was 3 years in which I had an opportunity to really get immersed in a range of subjects that I had no idea what was going on. And so it's funny, like in retrospect, I appreciate it more than I did in the moment, because I was often just lost in understanding 3, 4, 5, 20 cases at one time in each kind of class. But Yale was different, because even though, for instance, I didn't take property in law school.
What?
See?
How'd you get out of that?
You gotta take property.
Yeah, I didn't take property.
I'm jealous.
I got a D.
Yeah, I took it for the bar.
Right. Crash course.
Yeah, and I didn't take taxes. It's funny, though. I like property. And this is the thing, right? In retrospect, I might have done law school differently, because what law school did was just really, it's as if when I learned how to swim, I used to go to the swimming pool and tell the lifeguard, I was like, look, man, I could swim. I was like 7, 8 years old. I was like, I could swim. I don't want to be in the shallow end with these little kids. Man, I could swim. I should be with my boys playing sharks in the water. And he's like, you can't swim. Can you pass the test? And I was like, why everybody talking about a test? I don't need a test to demonstrate that I could swim. And the guy picked me up and tossed me in the water, right?
Oh, no.
And the thing was, I could swim, but I didn't have the stamina to pass the test. Mm. So I swam like halfway back, and then I was like about to drown. And they threw me something to hold on to, and then I used that to kick myself back to the edge. And they was like, all right, you can swim. And I was able to go back, you know, in the deep end. And that's what law school does, though. It throws you in the deep end, and it doesn't really give you anything to hold on to. And then 3 years later, when you're studying for the bar, you begin to, like, realize, oh, if I take a step back, I know some of these things.
Well, Dwayne, you're about to get thrown into the water again, because when you pass the bar exam, you're going to start a job. Talk about what you're going to be doing.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, one, I also already do it. I work at the public defender's office in New Haven, and so I think the only thing that'll change once I passed the bar too, and I got this complicated.
Oh, congratulations!
Thank you. But I got this complicated situation where, like, I passed the bar, but I know I have a character fitness exam to go through, and the state of Connecticut may very well decide that they don't feel that I'm fit to practice law, because when I was 16, I carjacked somebody. And it's not to sort of diminish the crime that I committed at 16, but I hope that, you know, my life post-incarceration and even while I was incarcerated demonstrate that, I made a mistake, but it wasn't a life-defining mistake as such. But it's interesting, though, because I represent clients now, and I represent clients. I mean, I have a 15-year-old client with a robbery charge, a 16-year-old client with a robbery charge, and I'm frequently returning to jail cells and returning to prisons, talking to people who are facing the same kind of circumstances that I faced. And I don't know, it's complicated, and it's wild, because what I tell them, and I think what I'll tell them at this speech I give on Friday, is that you can't really predict what you'll end up doing in this life, and you really got to leave yourself open. Because if somebody would have told me at 20 that, look, you'll be an attorney and you'll be representing some kid, like, I would have laughed at him, and I wouldn't have believed him. So in that way, I feel like I've already been thrown back into the deep end, but in doing this, I've been thrown back into the deep end to contemplate, really, what would I say to myself if I could meet my 16-year-old self, and also, what kind of attorney would I want if I had a decision to make about what kind of attorney I got? Because it's, you know, it's all kinds of different attorneys, and many of them are good, but that doesn't mean that they're, like, satisfactory in terms of meeting the needs of somebody that's in a really unfortunate situation.
That's so true. I always felt in law school that life experience should be required before law school, because so many people really had not been exposed to the realities of the criminal justice system.
Well, most of law school is about whacking up property. And our good friend Michael Deutsch, who used to be the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, when he got out of law school, he said, the one thing I don't want to do is get a job helping rich people make more money. And Heidi thought the same thing, and so did I, and so do you. And, you know, you live in the present, and you can't think about where you're going to end up. You do what you're doing day to day, and you end up in a good place. And it certainly sounds like you're starting off in a good place.
We love your book, Bastards of the Reagan Era. Would you be willing to read a poem from it if you have a favorite one?
Yeah, I'll read one. I have one. I don't know if I have a favorite. My favorite one might be the long poem. Actually, I'll tell the truth. I've been able to read from the poems from the book at a lot of different places, and my favorite poem changes all the time.
Okay.
But this is the poem that I generally always start reading with, and one of the reasons is that it's I don't know, it speaks to me, but it also allows me to do some of the things that I like to see poets do. So it's "For the City That Nearly Broke Me." A woman tattoos Malik's name above her breast and talks about the conspiracy to destroy blacks. This is all a fancy way to say that someone kirked out, empty five or six or seven shots into a still warm body. No indictment follows Malik's death, follows the smoke running from a fired pistol, an old quarrel, crimson against concrete, and the officer's gun still smoking. Someone says the people need to stand up, that the system's a glass house falling on only a few heads. This and the stop snitching ads are the conundrum, and damn all that blood. All those closed eyes imagining Malik's killer forever coffled to a series of cells. And you almost believe them. You do. Except the cognac in your hand is an old habit. A toast to friends buried before the daybreak of their old age. You know the truth of the talking, of the quarrels, and how history lets the blame go blameless for the blood that flows black in the street. You imagine there's a riot going on and someone is tossing a trash can through Sal's window, calling that revolution. While behind us, cell doors keep clinking closed, and Malik's casket door clinks closed, and the bodies that roll off the block and into the prisons and into the ground keep rolling. And no one will admit that this is the way America strangles itself.
Wow, that's powerful.
Dwayne, who are the bastards of the Reagan era? Who do you describe as bastards? You?
No, it's kind of interesting, right? Because I think it's complex, and it's so part of the title is rooted in my work in D.C. I used to teach poetry in middle schools and high schools in D.C. And what I found is it was more than just my generation that was more or less fatherless. And I know it's all kinds of things about let me find a way to push back against this trope and this idea that black children are fatherless and black men are fathers. And I get that, but I'm more so speaking about my own experience and speaking about my experience both as a kid living in D.C. and, well, living right outside of D.C. and in D.C. for some time, but, like, not really knowing too many of my peers who had fathers and not really having too many interactions with grown men. The first time I interacted with 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 30, 40, 50-year-old men were in prison. And I think that is a tragedy. And so part of the bastards of the Reagan era, I'm talking about my generation, but I'm also talking about the generation of young people that I taught, you know, kids who, you know, could be my children if I had children really young, but are, like, just below the age where I started having children. So my oldest son is 9. I'm talking about kids that's, like, 17 right now, kids that's 18. When I was in school, I mean, when I was teaching them, frequently there were no fathers around. And so what the bastards of the Reagan era is really talking about a kind of generational change that has occurred in many communities across the country, because if you look at the prison population and you can see the number of black men that's incarcerated, then you recognize that those men aren't replaced in the community, right? The community exists without their presence there. And so I'm talking about, and I'm talking about really the way in which we father children, even when they aren't our own children. And so those men are men that you would have seen, hopefully, just out, taking out the grocery, taking out the trash, going to the grocery store, sitting on a stoop, going to work. Those are men that would have had a presence in the community who don't have a presence. And I know that to create the space and the opportunities for them to have a vibrant presence means that we have to address some other problems. But none of those problems really matter if you've disappeared the whole community. And at this point, I think we've basically disappeared huge swaths of the communities across the country.
That's right. You were appointed by President Barack Obama to the Coordinating Council of the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. What was that like?
It was interesting. I think
bureaucratic.
It was an honor to be appointed. I mean, I got a piece of parchment that says that I had this like official presidential appointment signed by President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And it was a moment in my life where I was like, I got this piece of paper that will be signed by two presidents, but that didn't happen.
Right.
So it was interesting, right, because it was just an opportunity. It was quality meetings. And OJJDP, they worked, you know, full-time 365 days a year. They work on these issues. They produce reports. They work with other agencies. They are like a funding source for people doing work in the community and in different spaces. But my role was really to go to these quality meetings, and at these quality meetings, there would usually be a presentation or something. And so, you know, I think about the drastic change in the political scene. I mean, I was there when Attorney General Holder, he basically commissioned a report and had a report done that was presented at one of our meetings, and the report was on, like, trauma-informed care. And it was talking about the fact that for far too long we've looked at young people who have, like, been incarcerated, been in juvenile detention centers, and we haven't had any kind of care that acknowledged the kind of trauma that they'd experienced before the crime had been committed and the impact of that trauma and what that had on their lives. And so it was interesting to see that. It was interesting to be a part of that and then to see the different agencies respond to that. Because one of the things I didn't know before I got involved with this was that criminal justice reform and really the machinery of the criminal justice system, all of these federal agencies, they have a role. It's not just one federal agency. It's literally every single federal agency will have some small portion of what they do that's somehow intersected with criminal justice reform. And you know, and could, in a different world, be an agent for ramping up incarceration. So that was important for me to witness, because I got a chance to, like, glimpse inside the way government works when you're dealing with just a massive system that we have in the United States.
Wanted to ask you, what was going through your mind the night Donald Trump was elected president?
I don't know. It's one of the, first it seemed impossible.
Right.
And then it seemed inevitable. And at the point that it seemed inevitable, I think I started asking myself questions about what does it mean to engage with the political landscape. I started regretting the fact that I think that we didn't really seize the opportunity of President Obama's presidency in a way that we might have. And when I say we, I'm thinking about myself, but I'm also thinking about the artistic community. I'm thinking that we could have just been more ambitious, and that I feel like when I reflect on some of the conversations I had and some of the conversations I had with others, even through the Clinton and Trump campaign, it was really deeply pessimistic. And it's this weird way in which having the opportunity to create change and be a real force in change led to a kind of pessimism, because change is more difficult. And I think in some ways that pessimism was one of the things that was rooted in the possibility of a Donald Trump. Because, I mean, look, I spent most of my, at this point, I spent nearly as much of my life in college as I have in prison. And this is just not what I would have expected in the middle of my prison sentence, and it's definitely not what I expected just after just graduating from Yale Law School. So I don't know. I will say I'm not as much devastated as like now keenly aware that some of us have to have a far more active role in the change that we want to see, even if it's something as simple as the criminal justice system, or if really as complex as the criminal justice system. Because it's huge problems in the criminal justice system that, like, many people don't ignore and have no sense of how to be an agent of change in that system. And I think that's one of the things that leads to pessimism. So what I hope, I think, and what I've been encouraged by is to look at this as an opportunity, and to look at this as an opportunity to say that in each of my encounters with people, when I had these public speaking engagements, when I talked to my friends, how do I give them a means and opportunity to engage in small ways and a change that they want to see? So this is whether it's immigration, because I have friends who are deeply involved in representing people that are seeking asylum and representing people that are fighting deportation, and that's not my issue. But now I'm forced to ask myself, like, how do I have a stake in that issue, and how do I talk to people that I'm close to about that issue so that they become more aware of that issue, so that they aren't limited in their knowledge, so that the next time, you know, the next election, the next two or three elections, we know that this is the kind of thing that can never happen again.
A lot to think about. How can our listeners read more of your really wonderful poetry?
And find out where you might be appearing.
Right.
So my publisher is great, and they're also great about telling everybody when I have a read and then telling everybody when I have new work coming out. And that publisher is Four Way Books out of New York. And you can reach them at their website. You just Google Four Way Books, the website will come up. And you can also purchase books directly from them, as a small press is always great when people buy books directly from the small press. My book's also available in bookstores. And if you go into a bookstore and they say they don't have it, you can just ask them to order it, and they would definitely order it. And that will encourage them to keep more books on stock. And you could go to my website, DwayneBetts.com. That has more information about me. It has links to poems. It also has some links to poems that I recorded, some audio stuff that I had a partnership with a friend of mine, and she's playing piano, and I'm reading the poems. So you could do both of those things. And then finally, if you go to the website, you can find different places to purchase the books as well. Both the two poetry books, Bastards of the Reagan Era and Shahid Reza's Own Poem, and the memoir, which was published by Penguin Random House, which is A Question of Freedom.
Reginald Dwayne Betts, a recent law school graduate, and we're certain soon to be attorney. I wonder, Dwayne, might you favor us with one more poem before we have to say goodbye?
Yeah, I'll read a poem. It's called Triptych. But four is always game. A man can be murdered twice, but for science. His body a pool of blood in Baltimore and Tulsa, except it isn't. His body actually slender against the sunlight just outside a California prison. A crow rests on a fence near his car. Visiting hours long done. For man, not crow, one of a murderous many that flies above this barbed wire. And the cigarette he smokes is illegal here. And but for the magnetic pull tragedy has on black women, he wouldn't be here right now, contemplating the crimson-colored man leaping into the darkness of his Nikes. He still says Air Jordans because air is important. Adjectives swearing to black America's aim, if not ability, to soar. A way to outrun statistics and the lead in the water. Alas, metaphysics says you are only you and no one else. And a black poet says black love is not one or 1,000 things. And it all may be true, but for the fact that the man swears, the crow looks at him dead, as if he is already so. As if, while standing there, he has been murdered by his brother, murdered by a cop, embodied by a prison sentence as flames from a Newport's burning ash illuminate his corpse.
Dwayne Betts, you've just come out with the book Bastards of the Reagan Era. Four Ways Press published it. You're waiting to get into the bar. You're doing some good work, and Heidi and I are really grateful for your being on Law and Disorder.
Yes, we really admire you in many ways.
I'm grateful as well. I enjoyed myself. I appreciate the interview. It was great, and I love that story about Etheridge, so that was really important for me to hear.
Oh, good. Let's stay in touch.
All right, thanks. You guys have a great day.
Thank you.
You take it easy.
Bye-bye.
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 Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Like the United States, where its colonists settled upon, displaced, and controlled the Native American population, Israel is also a settler colonial state. Israel drove 750,000 Palestinians out when it was just established in 1948, and then it seized control of the land on the West Bank of the Jordan River and Gaza in 1967, and after that has militarily occupied and controlled the Palestinian population of nearly 2 million people ever since. Israel's settler colonialism experience has provided it with a valuable lesson and skills ripe for export to other state powers confronted with the challenges of population control. Despite the United Nations Security Council's condemning Israel, it has continued its illegal, defiant, and hostile commitment to expansion. How does it get away with this? Jeff Halpern, in his book War Against the People, has written that of the 157 countries with which Israel has diplomatic relations, virtually all the agreements and protocols Israel has signed with them contain military and security components. Among the many countries that Israel collaborates with, the government of the United States and Israel have exchange programs that bring together American police, including the New York City Police, ICE, the Border Patrol, and the FBI on the U.S. side, and soldiers, police, and border agents from Israel. Here to talk to us today is Ari Wallfiler, one of the leaders of Jewish Voice for Peace, JVP has recently launched a campaign called Deadly Exchange, Ending U.S.-Israel Police Exchanges, Reclaiming Safety. JVP has over 200 online supporters and over 60 chapters. Ari is one of the leaders of the organization.
Ari, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here.
You've recently launched a new campaign. You call it Deadly Exchange, Ending U.S.-Israel Police Exchanges, Reclaiming Safety. Tell us about it.
Great. So just to back up a little bit, Jewish Voice for Peace is a national grassroots organization, and our mission is to bring about a just and lasting peace in Israel-Palestine by getting the U.S. out of the way. So our fundamental analysis is that the U.S., far from being a neutral arbiter or a facilitator of peace, right, actually provides intense and extreme one-sided diplomatic, military, and economic support for Israel, and that it's our job, especially as American Jews, right, knowing that the Israeli government speaks in our name, to change U.S. policy so that actually the people who live there can negotiate a lasting solution, that they're the ones who are going to have to live with whatever they come up with. So we spend a lot of time and energy looking at the nature of the U.S.-Israeli relationship. And one of the things that we've spent some effort in the last few months really looking at are these police exchange programs, which is basically like on the model of birthright for cops, right? So police agents, ICE agents, sheriffs.
Well, birthright, we should just tell people, is this organization, Birthright in America, sends eager but unwitting young American Jewish kids over to Israel and shows them a Potemkin village and sells them on the project of Zionism.
That's a fair assessment. So, again, it's a two-way exchange, though. I should also make very, very clear. So, on the U.S. side, police forces here go on these field trips to Israel, and then also IDF soldiers, national police, other members of the Israeli security and military establishment come over here to the United States for mutual training, sharing of tactics, discussion of ideology, relationship building. And the more that we look at those, the more that we realize that these exchanges are, you know, politically and literally deadly, right? What they're exchanging are the tools that they use, right, that in both societies to police, imprison, arrest, and control racial minorities and the populations in both societies that they're targeting.
So domestic dissenters as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely.
So in Israel, you got a captive population of Palestinians.
Right.
In America, you got black and brown people, working class people. Same problem, different countries.
Right, and it's even a little more overlapping, right? So obviously the Palestinians are the main target of the Israeli government, but also you can look at Ethiopian Jews, you can look at Mizrahi Jews, you can look at refugees, right? There's a whole bundle of different populations and overlapping populations in Israel-Palestine that are being targeted, just like in the United States. You can also look at refugees, you can look at Muslims, you can look at black people, you can look at queer and trans people. So it's an intersectional targeting, right, even though the effect is the same in each case.
And when we talk about sharing information, do they also share, like, new weapons, new methods of so-called crowd control, bad practices?
Right. So we do talk about this as a worst practices exchange, right? That's what is fundamentally being shared. And there's a whole other sort of track of these exchanges that is the direct sales of weapons technology or surveillance technology in particular. The research that we've done so far, what it shows is that on the Israeli side, what is being shared is in particular surveillance tactics and technology. So one of the things that is true there is that there's even fewer safeguards between different levels of the state in terms of how information can be shared. So essentially from, you know, the traffic cop through the head of state security, everybody has the same database. Everybody can share the same information. It's not that dissimilar from the U.S., but even ever so much more so. On the U.S. side, what we're sharing there is essentially broken windows policing. So stop and frisk, other types of predictive policing, right? Saturation policing, community policing is what the U.S. is bringing to the equation and sharing out with their counterparts over there.
Are their tactics more militarized than ours?
I think the types of occupation, military occupation that are ongoing in both places are really different, right? If you look at the ongoing occupation of this continent, it's a lot older and in some ways more established than the occupation of Palestine. So I wouldn't say that they're more militarized. I think that they're very differently militarized. And I also think one of the things we have to keep in mind is that you know, quote unquote, regular policing is just as violent in many cases as militarized policing, right? If you look at what happened to Eric Garner, he was killed with somebody's bare hands. He wasn't killed with super fancy technology, right? If you look at what happened to Michael Brown, he was shot with a regular gun, right? He wasn't killed with some fancy technology. So the militarization of both countries, I think, is extremely pronounced, but also just the general attitude of racism and violence is shared as well.
I understand that Israeli biomedical engineers came up with skunk spray. What is that? How is it used?
So skunk spray is poison, and it's used as a crowd control technique. It's basically a chemical mixture that they spray over a huge area.
So it's not from the little black animals?
No, okay, not at all. It smells horrible. It hurts. It sticks to your clothing. You aspirate it. It's bad for your body. It's hard to get out. They spray it on your house. It can stay in your house for days, weeks, months. So it's designed as a crowd dispersal strategy, but also just as punishment, right? It's not something that goes away as soon as the crowd goes away. It's a long-term form, right, of punishment and discouragement, right, for Palestinians to engage in a struggle for their self-determination.
Is that widely used, to your knowledge?
It is, yeah, and especially, I think, in the West Bank, where there are, you know, active nonviolent protests on an ongoing basis.
Ari, do you know if Israel had anything to do with the training of repressive forces in Ferguson or Standing Rock or Black Lives Matter?
Right. So we do know that the police chief in Ferguson has been on one of these trips. And we know that actually the police chiefs of most cities in this country have been to Israel one way or another through one of these programs. I don't think that there's like a conspiratorial single connection between them that we're going after, right? I think it is much more systemic. But we do know that, again, you know, what's happening in Standing Rock and what's happening in Palestine, again, those are both examples, right, of indigenous people struggling for their rights, and the companies and the government agencies trying to hem them in, right, are obviously working together and learning from each other, whether or not that's direct, right? They have TVs, they have Twitter, they have Facebook too, right? They can learn what's going on.
I'm curious, who organizes these exchanges in the United States, and who's paying for this? Are tax dollars going?
So there's a range of organizations paying for them because there's a range of trips. So some of them will not surprise any of you. There are groups like Birthright, right, which specializes in these sort of propaganda pro-Israeli tours. There's also far-right groups. There's an organization called Jinsa that's sort of the Jewish neocon think tank. And this is one of their main programs. What we're actually looking at and feels really interesting and disturbing to us is that actually there are some groups that strive to have a more liberal reputation that also are deeply invested in these tours. So the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, depending on your perspective, has either, you know, has a quite liberal reputation in this country as a civil rights organization, sponsors one of the largest tours, and is one of the biggest funders of these trips around. And I think, again, that's one of the reasons why Jewish Voice for Peace is invested in this campaign, because it's being led by and funded by and organized by an organization that claims to speak for the Jewish American community. And we don't think that that's right.
But what would the ADL get out of this?
Well, you know, the ADL over the years has really transformed into one of the main institutions supporting Israel, right or wrong, in the United States, right? So in policy and media, in the Jewish community, so much of their work has really unfortunately collapsed the distinction between anti-Semitism and criticism of Israel, right? Such that anything you say critical of this government or anything you say that might weaken the apartheid system in Israel is ipso facto anti-Semitic. And that's a really sad story, fundamentally. But I think that's really the explanation for why they're so invested in maintaining these police exchanges between here and there.
The ADL lost its liberal patina for me many years ago when it came out that they were in San Francisco spying on the people who were in solidarity with El Salvador. It was an organization called CSPES, and it came out that they were sharing their information with the American police against CSPES because the United States was intervening to try to halt the people's movement in El Salvador. Why do you think that these organizations that support and run these exchanges, why do they do it?
I think that the belief that the U.S. and Israel should be tightly connected runs really deep, and it runs especially deep in the Jewish community, right? That's one of the things we're taught in synagogue, in day school, by the media, by our family, by our grandparents, by our friends, everywhere, right? And I think that there's also a widespread belief in both countries that the police are good, right? And that the police make us safe and that the police are there naturally and for the benefit of all. So I think that really what this campaign is doing is trying to point out the false and racist assumptions embedded on both of those sides, right? One, that the U.S. and Israel should have a governmental relationship based in military exchange. And secondly, that the police are here to make us safe. And I think that we really want to get into that with people and talk more about, like, well, what would make us safe? What would meet our needs? And what type of relationship would we want to have with people in Israel, with people, with Palestinians, with people here in the U.S.? What could that look like?
Ari, talk about Israel's training of repressive forces in countries other than the United States.
Right. So this is not a monogamous exchange, right, on either side. Right. So we know that, again, the Israeli economy is one of the premier exporters of military and surveillance technology in the world. So that includes places like Sudan, that includes places like Colombia, that includes places like Brazil. So during the Olympics in 2016, whatever that was, Israeli firms were the main providers of security services to the Rio Olympics. And there's actually a lot of work growing in Israel itself, internally, against that broader exporting economy of defense and surveillance technology. So I think one of the real, actually, it's an exciting thing and a useful thing, right, that this isn't the only exchange we have to fight. And there's people from all over the world, literally, working on this problem and trying to figure out how to hem in these exchanges.
Can you give us an example of some of the efforts that you've undertaken specifically and what plans you have coming up?
Yeah, so the real focus of this campaign is going to be to try to get cities to opt out or disavow these programs. So we're incredibly, incredibly inspired, as so many other organizations are working on so many issues now, by this new sanctuary movement, right? And really saying, you know, it's not enough for a progressive mayor to get up and say, like, this is a sanctuary city. You got to make that mean something. And so this is one small part of it, but we do think it's an important part of it, which is to say, you can't be a sanctuary city if you're inviting the IDF to come train your local police forces. That does not create sanctuary, especially for Muslims, especially for Arabs, especially for poor people, right, for people of color. That's not sanctuary. So I think that that's one angle of the campaign, is really to go to these localities and to say, like, this, we don't need to participate in this, and we don't want to participate in this. That's also a form of boycott, right? And I think, you know, there's a global call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel until it abides by international law. So it's also a way of opting out of these programs is in the spirit of that BDS movement as well.
We're talking to Ari Wohlfeiler, who's one of the leaders of Jewish Voice for Peace. Ari, I wanted to ask you, because I don't want to forget this important question, is how can listeners get in touch with JVP?
Yeah, we try to make it easy. So you can find us online at jewishvoiceforpeace.org or just jvp.org. We also have a special website set up for this campaign with more information about the deadly exchanges, and that's just deadlyexchange.org.
All right, if you missed that, I'm going to ask that again of Ari.
JVP.org.
But Ari, if I might, on a personal note, how and why did you get involved with JVP?
You know, I think the short story is because my grandfather would have hated it. I think my grandfather was a Holocaust survivor, and he taught me a lot about what he went through. And I think the more I began to look at what happened, what is happening in Israel, and the real parallels to me, the more I couldn't resist doing something about it, right? And I think there's something really unique and special that American Jews can do to speak out on this issue. And our voice isn't the most important one or the only one, certainly. But because U.S. policy, you know, claims to have the support of the American Jewish community on this issue, and because Israel claims to speak for all Jews, it's really, really important that we speak out ourselves.
I remember Michael Ratner, who was on your board, talking about the definition of genocide. And it's not just limited to what the fascists in Europe did to the Jews. There are various forms of genocide. And Michael would always make the point that what the Israelis are doing in grinding down the Palestinians since 1948 is another form of genocide.
Yeah, I think that's a really valid point.
Jeff Halpert wrote an extremely important book about what JVP part of what JVP is doing to try to stop the United States from collaborating with Israel and vice versa. The book is called War Against the People, and the subtitle is Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification. Mm-hmm. And I want to read a couple sentences from the book and ask you to comment on it. Jeff writes, "The occupation represents a source for Israel in two senses. Economically, it provides a testing ground for the development of weapons, security systems, models of population control, and tactics without which Israel would be unable to compete in the international arms and security markets." but no less important, being a major military power serving another military and security services the world over lends Israel an international status among global hegemons it would not otherwise have. Israel is a small country scrambling to carve out a niche in the transnational military-industrial complex. Where would it be without the occupation and the regional conflict that it generates? What are your thoughts about that?
So my first thought is how sad that is. You know, I really think that it's important to remember, especially when we talk about these global flows of arms deals and technology, that it has a human cost, right? And that there's real people actually being targeted and killed and maimed by this technology in Israel and around the world. It's also absolutely right that, you know, one of the ways that Israel has built up its defense economy is by being able to market itself as these products as battle-tested, right? And that's disgusting, right? And also true.
Mm-hmm. Back 100 years ago, when the idea of Zionism, that is creating a national state for Jews in the Middle East, was first being kicked around in Europe, there was a lot of opposition to it. But the Zionists, for their part, went around to the various heads of states in important imperial countries. I'm talking about Russia, Germany, England, and it was finally England that agreed with them, and Lord Balfour declared that he was in favor of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. The myth, of course, was that there was nobody there. The sales pitch that the Zionists gave to the various heads of these imperial countries, which was successful with England, was that they would look out for their interests once they established a country in the Middle East. And the Zionists didn't get very far, until much later, after the Second World War, when there was a lot of international feeling that something should be done at last for the Jews. And they were allowed via a UN resolution to settle in Palestine, or really settle upon the Palestinians. Isaac Deutscher used to say that if you're in a burning building and you have to jump out of the fifth floor and you land on somebody, at least you should say you're sorry. Well, the Zionists never said they were sorry. And they've managed to build up this incredible military power. They're one of the top 10 in the sales of military equipment around the world. I think that's what's so tragic, I think, about the Jewish experience, and really undercuts the moral authority that Jews had gained for 2,000 years. And I'm anticipating, and I want to ask you about this, Thursday Trump's going to make a decision about whether Jerusalem should be given to Israel as the Israeli capital. That decision has been forestalled for the last 20 years. And of course, the Zionists, and including the Christian Zionists in the United States, are hot to have the Israelis take over Jerusalem, which would preclude the Palestinians from having Jerusalem as their capital. And what are your thoughts about the way things are going with the Trump administration and Israel?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. And I think the first thing I want to just add to your great summary of the last 100 years is that also this has been a tragedy within the Jewish community, right? And that Israel was given to European Jews, and that there were already Jews living there. There are Jews living throughout North Africa and the Arab world who were not allowed to be subjects of that Zionist project, right? And there's still a huge amount of discrimination against Mizrahi and Sephardic Jews within Israeli society. And we have to really remember that those power dynamics are a huge part of what shapes the Israeli government's approach overall. In terms of Trump, you know, I'm hopeful that he's not actually going to move the embassy on when the waiver expires. So for those who don't know, official U.S. law right now is that the embassy should be moved to Jerusalem, but presidents are allowed to waive it for 6 months at a time. And over the last 20 years since this law was implemented, every 6 months it's been waived with no question. I think what's interesting for us trying to figure out Trump's approach to the Middle East and in particular to Israel-Palestine is to try to figure out how two of the competing factions in his administration, or at least two, are going to play out and play against each other. So on the one side, you have his ambassador, David Friedman. You have people like Jared Kushner, who are true-believing, far-right, extremist Zionist, pro-settlement, pro-unification, pro-annexation. They're funders. They're agitators. They go there. They have deep ties there. They fully embrace a vision of Israel from the river to the sea with no room for Palestinians, right? It's an extremist and very much a fundamentalist vision, and that's terrifying. On the other side, you have Rex Tillerson, right, who's the Exxon dude, and he wants stability, right? That's what oil wants. So he, I think, is actually in some ways in this horrific balance, a little bit of a break on some of those more religious and fanatical ideas coming from Friedman or Kushner maybe, but we're going to have to see. I think one of the things we all need to be doing a lot of work to prepare for is the potential for another quote-unquote peace process to be launched, right? And we know that that's something that, you know, since the Oslo Accords in the early 90s, every president has tried at least once. It has always ended up with Israel having more land, having more power, being in a stronger bargaining position, being less willing to cede anything, with a weakened Palestinian authority. So I think that actually more than the embassy, I think the real threat is the same old threat, right, is that the U.S. is going to try to impose a solution under the guise of a peace process instead of the U.S. getting out of the way and evening the negotiating table so people there can negotiate in good faith.
Ari, give us that website again so people can get in touch with Jewish Voice for Peace.
Great. We're at jvp.org, and you can find out more about the Deadly Exchange campaign at deadlyexchange.org.
Ari, it was fascinating to talk with you today, and we hope to stay in touch over the next few months.
Likewise, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks
so much for being on Law & Disorder. Ari Wildfire.
Law & Disorder has been broadcasting for nearly 13 years now. We started on WBAI in New York City and are now carried on nearly 100 affiliate stations across the country. We'd like to take a moment to thank them.
WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. KRFP 90.3 FM, Radio Free Moscow, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN 107.5 FM, Nashville, Tennessee. KSOW 106.7 FM, Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP 101.7 FM, Clay, West Virginia.
KRFC 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD 90.7 FM, Kasilof, 104.5 FM radio, Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts.
KEIF-FM 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. WPVM 103.9 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago. Motion Community House Radio, online.
WLRI 92.9 FM, Gap, Pennsylvania. WPRR 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS 102.1 FM, Columbus Community Radio, 98.3 FM, Central Ohio. KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, WSLR-FM 96.5, Sarasota, Florida, KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Around Radio, Lorain Community College Radio, WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut,
WJFF Radio Catskill 90.5 FM, WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin.
That's where I used to go fishing with Michael Ratner.
WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine, 99.9 FM, Bangor, Maine, Redwood Community Radio.
KMUD 91.1 FM, Garberville, California. KMUE 88.3 FM, Eureka, California. KLAI 90.3 FM, Laytonville, California. Voice of Sacramento 88.7 FM, Sacramento Community Radio.
WWPM MediaNet, Nokomis, Illinois. Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass., where I grew up. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass., where I did three semesters.
Well, you dropped out.
KSER FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington. WCRS LPFM 98.3 FM and 102.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ 94.9 FM, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU 90.7 FM, Illinois Central College, Peoria, Illinois.
WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR 91.7 FM, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS 92.3 FM and 89.9 FM, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, The Eye, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Massachusetts. WFTE 90.3 FM and 105.7 FM, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. Rochester Free Radio, WRFI 91.9 FM, Watkins Glen. WINO 89.9 FM, Odessa, and 88.1 FM, Ithaca, New York. WEFT 90.1 FM, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix, Online Community Radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio, Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes. KAOS 89.3 FM, Olympia, Washington. KWTF, Sonoma County, California.
Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas. KBOO 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Portland. 100.7 FM, Corvallis. 91.9 FM, Hood River. WSCA 106.1 FM, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. WZRD 88.3 FM, Chicago, Illinois.
KOWA 106.5 FM, Olympia, Washington. WRIR 97.3, Richmond, Virginia. KMEC 105.1 FM, Ukiah, California. KSVU 90.1 FM, Concrete, Washington. WXPI 88.5 FM, Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
KNSJ 89.1 FM, San Diego, California. KGHI 91.1 FM, Westport, Washington. Our Streaming Planet podcast. WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C. KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas. 89.7 FM, Huntsville, Texas. 89.5 FM, Galveston, Texas. WOOL FM 91.5 FM, Bellow Falls, Vermont. Black Sheep Radio.
KGIG 104.9 FM, Salida, California. KEUL 88.9 FM, Girdwood, Alaska. KRDILP 103.1 FM, Duval, Washington. WUMD 89.3 FM, University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. KWRKLP 90.9 FM, Alaska Peace Center, Fairbanks, Alaska.
WGRNLP 94.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York. WHYRLP 96.9 FM, Baton Rouge Community Radio, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Workforce Rising Online.